WHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Branson, together with my co-host, Gina McAndrews. Welcome, Gina.
It's great to be here, Susan. So, what do we have for today?
First, we need to report the outcome of the bond issues. Super Tuesday in central Iowa, there were other issues besides presidential candidates. One was for an elementary school in Collins-Maxwell, and the other was in Madrid.
Okay, well, what did you hear? What did you find out? Did they pass?
Yes. This morning's Ames Tribune reports that Collins-Maxwell passed with 84%. Now, it failed before.
Wow.
So this is a revote, and more people turned out.
That's terrific.
And Madrid, that was a $7.8 million project, by the way. Pretty big for Collins-Maxwell. Madrid's was a $5.8 million project, and it passed with 62.52% of the vote.
That's terrific.
Yes. So, good news for Central
Iowa. Education.
Good news for education in Central Iowa.
But I know one of the bigger stories in Boone County this week was the wind farm. You spoke with Max Jabrixo at the Great Pathfinder Wind Project, didn't you?
Yes, I did. And he had a lot of interesting things to say. Let's listen in.
My name is Max Jabrixo. I'm the Public Engagement Manager for the Great Pathfinder Wind Project and for Apex Clean Energy in Iowa.
And could you tell us a little about Apex Clean Energy?
Absolutely. So Apex Clean Energy is a renewable energy developer and operator. We're headquartered in Charlottesville, Virginia, and have a little over 200 employees across the United States. And we started in 2009, and in the 11 years that we've been in business, we have financed over $7 billion worth of renewable energy opportunity in the U.S.
Now, you're in Boone for wind. Are some of your projects solar also?
Yes. So solar is a little bit newer to Apex's portfolio. A lot of our early projects are wind, but we do have a really growing solar development portfolio as the technology is getting more and more efficient.
The wind technology has also developed a lot since 2009. Is that right?
It has, yes. So in the, I believe since 2012, the total amount of installed wind in the U.S. has quadrupled. So it's a really growing sector of the industry. Wind turbine technicians and maintenance is the second fastest growing career in the United States. And the turbines themselves have also gotten a lot more efficient. So wind is now in the levelized cost of energy, maybe the most cost-effective form of energy generation that there is.
Have you done any other projects in Iowa?
We have. So Apex recently developed the Upland Prairie Wind Project, which is in Clay and Dickinson County. And that project is now owned by Alliant Energy. But that's a 300-megawatt wind farm, which started operating in 2019.
Now, you said it's now operated by Alliant. A lot of the wind that I know about is operated by Alliant. Is it unusual for them to, how did that go from being Apex to Alliant?
Yeah, great question. So the projects that we develop, we typically do sell or reach an agreement with a third-party financer. In some cases, that is a utility like Alliant Energy. But in a lot of cases, that can also be a corporate partner. We've had the opportunity to work with some really major corporations across the U.S., like Facebook, McDonald's, IKEA, and we often, with corporate partners, will continue to operate the project on their behalf.
Well, it does sound a little like a wind project by McDonald's. Does sound a little surprising.
Yeah, it's been a really exciting trend for us to see so many major companies that are seeing the benefits of investing in renewable energy. And, of course, there's a component of that that is based on their values and wanting to be a part of the transition to clean energy. And they know that customers are more likely to frequent companies that are making commitments to go green energy. But there's also a big part of that that's around their balance sheet. A big corporation like Facebook or McDonald's doesn't make that decision if it doesn't make financial sense. And they know that they're able to lock in a long-term, stable, low-cost source of electricity generation by investing in renewables.
Well, I'm curious about why you chose Boone. There's lots and lots of wind visible in Story County. In fact, when I went up to Ziering, I was surprised at the density of the windmills up there. It was just amazing to me. Now, I know there are a few windmills in Boone County, but could you tell me anything about how you chose Boone County and what the process was of selecting your sites?
So there are a lot of factors that go into selecting sites like this. One of the really important ones, of course, is the existence of the wind resource there. So is there enough wind to make for a really efficient, cost-effective project? And so that's true for a lot of places within Iowa, but the area that we are working in, Boone and Hamilton counties, for this project is no exception to that. In addition to that, there's a really supportive community here that has been very welcoming. There is, because of the amount of existing agriculture, we have found that wind is really compatible with agricultural operations, and so that makes it another reason. That's another reason that Boone and Hamilton counties are a great choice for the location of this project.
You mentioned that this is very compatible with agriculture. Is that all kinds of agriculture? What about pastures?
Yeah, so it really is all equally compatible with livestock as it is with farming operations. One of the great things about wind turbines is, for folks who are growing row crops, turbine and the access roads and all of the total impact to the ground for a farmer who leases land is really minimal, typically less than an acre for a turbine and all of the associated facilities. And so that's a really small amount of acreage out of production for that farmer, which still generates a long-term and stable stream of income for that farmer that won't fluctuate the way grain prices do. But it's also equally good with livestock. So we have plenty of pictures up on our website of cows or sheep grazing right up to the base of turbines.
Occasionally, you hear from people who live near turbines that there are some downsides for them. Are there any protections in the siting to minimize those?
Yeah, so there are, I would say, a few common concerns that we hear come up or questions that folks will ask. One of those is about decommissioning. And so folks will ask, what happens at the end of the project? If the lifespan of turbines is expected to be 20 to 25 years, what's next after that? And there are regulations or requirements that before we ever begin construction, we submit a detailed plan for how we would decommission the project and restore all of the ground to its previous state. And we also put into place financial securities so that the county and landowners who might be participating in the project have confidence that even in the event that folks ask what happens if a company goes bankrupt, we think it's pretty unlikely, but you want to be prepared for a worst-case scenario. We put financial security into place before we begin construction so that folks know that they wouldn't potentially be stuck with the bill in that eventuality.
Some of the questions that I've heard had more to do with things like lights and how close they were to structures or roads. Are there regulations on that, or do you go farm by farm and say, you know, what are your concerns? How do you handle that?
Yeah, so there are regulations in place on that, and APEX also has our own internal siting guidelines that are based around, you know, what we know is the safe distance to site turbines. And so we, of course, have our own guidelines that we follow in every project we do, even in places that don't have as strict of regulations. But there is also in Boone County a wind ordinance that the county board just updated, which provides, you know, some clear frameworks around exactly where things should be sited, including setbacks from property lines, from roads, from dwellings and structures, all of which we will follow, of course.
But once your windmills are built, how do customers access the power? I mean, you don't buy it through McDonald's.
No, typically not. So power will still be delivered onto the grid. So for local electric consumers, they really wouldn't see a change in how it is that you're purchasing the power. The addition of a low-cost energy generation source like wind can have positive effects for electricity prices for consumers in the area, but there are also a lot of other factors that go into play for the electricity rates that consumers end up paying. And so we can't predict exactly what those rates are going to do in the future.
It seems to me that thinking about those hot days in the summer when you want to have your air conditioning on, everybody wants to use as much power as possible. I mean, they don't want to, but that's the way it works. This is the ideal time to have solar available because often when it's hot, there isn't any wind.
The governing body that kind of regulates all of the different power that's going onto the grid is MISO. And so MISO is kind of the governing body that regulates everything to do with our electrical grid here in the Midwest. And before we ever construct a project and are able to interconnect it to the grid, MISO does a series of studies to understand, based on all of the new projects that might be coming online, all of the power that's going to be connected up, and when we expect that to be producing, and based on when consumers are expected to be using more or less power, have they gotten their balance right to where they know that they have the amount of power they need when they need it, essentially. And so MISO is the one that regulates that. But for us, we certainly are seeing a growing demand in both wind and solar because we know that diversifying the energy production that's going onto that grid can be really helpful as solar obviously is producing more at certain times where wind might be producing more at other times. And that allows us to essentially balance out the load that's being produced.
Well, it occurs to me that the advantages of wind that you've talked about that doesn't interfere with farming, and it's, well, that's a major one. You can still use the land, is not true for solar. You know, in California, it's great. You have lots of deserts where you can won't be interfering with agriculture. But in Iowa, we don't have very many places. What do you do? How do you find your solar sites?
To that point, that's one of the reasons that Great Pathfinder Wind seems like the right choice for this location, because we know that it's important to the county to keep much of that land in agricultural production. I guess the one note that I will make on solar as it relates to agricultural production is it's true that in the time that the solar project is up, that land may not be used for row crops or for that type of intensive agricultural production, but there are ways that that land can be used that are actually really, really beneficial for long-term agricultural production. So you think about programs like CRP, where the federal government is actively incentivizing folks to take land out of production for a period of time and to let that land go fallow so that it will be more productive when you put it back into production. And it's certainly possible to do something similar to that with the land that you are using for solar.
Well, are there any things that you think are important for our listeners to know that I have failed to ask you about?
There is one thing they should know about the Great Pathfinder Wind Project, which is that we have a community grant program that we have been running for some time in Boone and Hamilton counties. The grant program is a quarterly funding allocation for different nonprofits and community organizations that are running projects that benefit the citizens of Boone and Hamilton County. So, for example, in the past, we just funded the Boone Fire Department in January. We previously funded groups like the Stratford Early Learning Center and the Stratford Fitness Center. And we have $5,000 available every quarter for different programs and projects like that. So if you are a member of an organization, a Lions Club, Kiwanis Club, or anything like that, and you have a program that you'd like to be considered for funding, please go to our website at greatpathfinderwind.com/grant and apply. It's a really simple application. It's just a couple of questions about what your project is and how it will benefit folks in the county. And we would love to support work that other great organizations are doing in the area.
Well, thank you very much. This is a lot.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Suzanne.
Why do you do that?
Grant program for us is, I would say for me personally, it's a really important program because much of my background before I worked at Apex is in nonprofits. And so I know very well how difficult it can be to find funding for really important work. And so it's really exciting for me to get to be on the other side of that and to help support work that's really impactful in the community. And on a broader scale, it's just one additional tool that we have to help fulfill our vision of being a really great community partner and wanting to have a project that benefits folks in the counties that are playing host to these projects in as many ways as we can.
Sounds like a terrific project. And when do you expect this to be up and running?
So we would hope to be in commercial operations by the end of 2021. There are some factors outside of our control that could cause that to slip into 2022, but our hope and our goal is the end of 2021.
Okay. Thank you.
My pleasure.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and we just heard from Max Jabrixio, the Public Engagement Manager for Apex Renewable Energy, the organization that has been working on the Great Pathfinder Wind Project in Boone and Hamilton counties.
One of the things he mentioned was about the alternative ways to farm. He said, you know, the livestock were fine eating around in and around the windmills.
Yeah, that's interesting. I never that was certainly a question that I had.
Right. And I know there's always still talk about birds and bats and the impact they have on on the flying patterns.
Yes, but it's only the opponents of windmills, not the supporters of birds, that seem to be concerned about that. So that sort of tells you where the balance is. I just happen to have a recording from a recent forum dealing with regenerative agriculture, which has lots of interesting ideas. We'll be playing more segments on the Heart of Iowa soon, but I couldn't wait to play this, especially knowing that you'll be my co-host. There were many memorable talks, but the most striking was Finian Makepeace from an organization called Kiss the Earth. I'd like to have you listen to it with me and see what you have to say.
I was granted the opportunity to watch a four-hour presentation from a gentleman named Graham Sait, who is an international renowned soil expert from Australia. And what was shared with me blew my mind. Up until that point, I confidently believed that I was in the 90-plus 95th percentile of people who knew what was happening on the globe as far as environmentalism, destruction, climate change, etc. And then I was shocked that I had no idea about this potential, this opportunity that pioneering farmers and scientists and community leaders and indigenous leaders had been promoting for years around the world. So I knew that if I didn't know, probably most people were at least slightly unaware of this. It turned out a lot of people didn't know. This was 7 or 8 years ago. So what we got was we can rebuild healthy soil. And we can do it much faster than we ever thought possible. And I just want to make a note, in the past 7 years that I've been heavily involved in this movement, the understanding from the leaders and pioneers and farmers who are out there discovering this and sharing with each other, it's only getting better. What we thought we could do in 15 years on land, we're now accomplishing in 2 to 3 in terms of results of regenerating those landscapes for water, for biodiversity, for soil structure. So what this means is we have an unprecedented opportunity that our nation and nations around the world can take hold of. This isn't a new idea, but in the general conversation of humanity, it is. And that's a really exciting opportunity, because with new information and new opportunity means that there's actions to be taken, actions that can be taken, because we can reduce flooding and drought and fires. Why? Well, let's look at this. When we witness water infiltration rates in soils go from less than 0.5 inch per hour infiltration rates to 0.5 inch in just 4 seconds, we realize just how powerful regenerative agriculture is. Considering that this can be accomplished on farms in as little as 3 years, it drives home the effect that this can have on mitigating flood and drought events. This makes an unbelievable difference. Dr. Alan Williams, I've been to his ranches and farms. I've stepped across the road to the farms on the other side, and there is no possible way that you would believe what you saw. I mean, some of you are farmers and you know this, but you could take a shovel and just go all the way down in his soil right across the street. You can't do anything. So looking at the potential to rebuild the soil sponge, we can revive farmer prosperity. When we're looking at increasing the ability for reduction of inputs, significant to such an extent that in our second year, we saved over $200,000 by reducing input costs such as seed and pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and fertilizers, as well as reduced labor and fuel cost. We had also reduced glyphosate consumption by 80%, and we were glyphosate-free by year 3. That's a farmer who's gone through regenerative agriculture training and has been able to, first and foremost, address his bottom line and make a better profit because of that opportunity, because there was more fertility, because there was less need for input cost. We can recover biodiversity and environmental health. Remembering that there can be more organisms in a teaspoon of healthy soil than there are humans on planet Earth. And realizing the law of nature is life begets life begets life. You restore the bottom of the life, all of those things that once used to be 30-some-odd years ago existing, and we would see all the birds and the bees, they can come back when we restore the health of the base of the ecosystem. We can replenish water sources in cycles, reminding ourselves that 1% increase of soil organic matter means soil can hold 17,000 to 25,000 gallons more water per acre per year. How many of you know of Gabe Brown, regenerative rancher? So on his farm, he's increased soil organic matter by at least 7%. That means every acre of his land is now holding approximately 100,000 gallons more of water per acre than it was some 15 years ago. We can restore fertility and human health. Did anybody know the little quote that says, plants don't digest soil, microbes do? When we bring the fertility, the life back to the soil, something magical has happened. At the root zone, the rhizosphere, those sugars that the plant is leaking out to feed the microbes, those microbes are the ones responsible for putting out enzymes that actually make available those trace minerals, those nutrients. When you taste that strawberry or that tomato, your tongue is picking up what those microbes were able to make available for that plant so that they could make that powerfully tasting tomato or strawberry. If it doesn't have the taste, it doesn't have those minerals in it. Reconnecting humanity. I wanted to just share this from a friend of mine. It says, this is not about organic or conventional, big or small, rich or poor, red or blue. Sorry. There's a lot of divisions in our country right now. And ship's going down. And we have an opportunity. And this movement in regenerative agriculture and soil health is so inspiring because of the breadth of people who are working together. It's incredible. Because there's an insight and a foresight into how big of an opportunity this is for humanity. The reason that people are so heavily invested in far surpasses any of these issues that might come up. And finally, just a reminder that yes, this is one of the big aha moments. We can reverse global warming, or what is currently a load of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is causing additional heating, blanket of our atmosphere. We can pull that excess carbon back because we're building soil. I have a quote that I say is, carbon sequestration is not the ends. It is the means to the end, which is rebuilding the abundance and the potential and the capacity of our land to function again. 1% of soil organic matter can oftentimes mean 10 tons of carbon per acre sequestered. This is a helpful slide that I teach my soil advocates from around the world to use to help people bring their minds, especially when you're talking to politicians, people who are trying to invest in conservation, a good reminder that this regenerative idea is not sustainable. There's nothing wrong with sustainable, but we're trying to be clear that when we're talking about regeneration, we're not talking about put back what you take out. We're talking about starting from a diminished state, as the spiral indicates. Starting from a diminished state and ever increasing. It's a very different thought pattern than sustainable. So the pioneers of this movement who've taught me over these years have allowed me to, and others, to see that this is a different fundamental way of thinking. Thinking sustainably is not the same as thinking regeneratively. And I beg you to try it on if you haven't. It's a really fun thing to look at the lens of life through. Another way to look at it is over the last 10,000 years, and then obviously last 250, significantly faster, we have depleted the land. So we need to recognize that we're down there. You are there, we are there. That's where our world is right now, heavily degraded. Sustainability doesn't really make sense. We need to regenerate. And then, sure, fine. Sustainability, we say, is just ahead of its time. All those people with that in their job descriptions, they're just way ahead of their time. You can tell them that. So sustaining broken. A way to look at it really quick, a soil aggregate. How many of us have seen a soil aggregate up close? A soil aggregate's designed to hold 20 times its weight in water. It's universe's, this world's amazing technology that's evolved over millions and millions of years. When we break it, it's analogous to breaking a cup, which was designed to hold liquid. So when we look at our system, we're saying, how do we conserve, how do we sustain a broken cup? What is so freaking exciting about this movement is we can rebuild the cup because plants share liquid sugars to microorganisms who make glue, who literally glue the cup back together so it functions again. We can glue it back together, and simultaneously, magically, we just happen to take care of that big problem of legacy load of carbon dioxide. But the big point is we're building back the cup so it functions again. We're not trying to sustain a broken thing. We can rebuild healthy soil. Five principles. Reminder, you can use these slides. I'll share them with anybody. Five principles of soil health. We want our politicians to know this. I want each of you to feel empowered to be like, hey, Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so, you are my representative. We're in farm country. You should know this. They damn well should. Least disturbance. They should understand why that's a fundamental priority. Living root in the ground. They should understand that unless the microbes are getting fed, that's a one-way system out. That's a one-way system to degeneration. They should understand how important soil armor is. They should understand that animal integration is necessary. In California, we deal with a phenomenon that you can't have animals on land up 3 months before you harvest some other crop. It's completely disrupting nature's design and how farmers used to farm. We've separated them, and it just doesn't make any sense. Increased biodiversity, how important that is. So here's just some examples of seeing what leaders in Iowa, farmers here, have been on the forefront of pushing the cover crop thing. Amazing results. All across the country, we're dealing with water pollution issues, runoff issues. So many regenerative farms who are doing cover crops have gotten to zero runoff. 1 inch of rain means you're collecting in 1 acre 27,000 gallons of water if you have zero runoff. Incredible. So these factors can change everything. No-till. We're not disrupting those aggregates, those precious aggregates. When we're tilling, we're literally destroying them. So when we're looking at no-till, how can we all be advocates to say the farmers are ready, so many farmers are ready to go. We need some more support, and we need the funding and the subsidies to start going to things that are going to help farmers do this. There's enough momentum behind it. Getting farmers to be able to get off of that chemical train, restoring fertility. Again, I'm not a farmer trainer, but I've talked to some of the premier and furthest people who've gotten the best results, and they're able to get people. They're not saying get off nitrogen today. Your farm would just go crazy and die. We need to be able to wean farmers off, and that requires things like testing for organic available nitrogen, et cetera. So there are tools that can be used, and we all can help politicians say, hey, look, we need to start funding it so that farmers can confidently get off of this addiction so that they can have confidence that their farm is going to be profitable still while they're reducing their inputs. And that's what's making farmers' profit margins go up. Things like overgrazing versus planned grazing. Again, looking at this phenomenon of what happens in a situation, this is just a factor of how cows were moved, period. In an extremely dry part of South Africa with 8 inches of rainfall, the only difference is the management of how cows were moved. That's it. So regeneration is possible everywhere. We can do it. We can solve the carbon issue when we understand how nature evolved. The earth and the natural process didn't evolve to have soil loss. Otherwise, the whole earth would be rock and desert. It's designed to have net gain, and we can work within our farms. And this is the thing is, I teach people to be able to advocate for this. I'm not an expert. I'm not the farmer. But all of us can step up and be a little more helpful in awareness spreading and advocacy, even if we're doing the main work ourselves. All of us can say, hey, you know what? Why don't I go to that council meeting? Why don't I go to that Congress office and talk to them? 20 major civilizations have failed due to the collapse of agriculture. How arrogant would we be to presume the root cause of our collapse won't be the exact same thing? True farmer prosperity, higher yields, less input cost, stacked enterprises. Replenished water cycles, ground recharge, clean water, drought resistance. Less CO2, carbon sequestration. At Kiss the Ground, we're dedicating to putting 5,000 farmers in 3-year training programs of soil testing year 1 and year 3 with the Soil Health Academy and other premier farmer training programs. We're also committed to training at least 25,000 leaders to be more powerful advocates for soil health by 2025. I am deeply humbled to be here. I just want to say 100% clearly that I am here only because of the extraordinary work and dedication of those who have built the consciousness of this movement, the farmers who have actually done the work and proven and shown and shared, and the generosity of the people who are in this movement, not hoarding their ideas, is so extraordinary. I never thought it would be real, but the people who are the pioneers of this, they see that's what's possible, and they are sharing. None of them are saying, I found out the key to making a successful farm business, and I'm going to keep it myself. They're the most generous, giving, caring people, and they're from all different walks of life, and I'm just so honored to be here with you, and I believe firmly that together we can transform this country and the world by building back America's soil. Together we can do this. Thank you so much.
Gina? I think we need to react to that a little bit before we move on. This is KHOI Community Radio, but we've just been listening to Mr. Makepeace, and he is he's speaking about regenerative agriculture, and it sounds pretty radical to me. What does it sound like to you?
Well, I think it sounds very inspiring, and it's also coordinated with a lot of new research that's going on. The Practical Farmers of Iowa also had a professor, Dr. Nicole Masters from New Zealand, who spoke very similarly. She has done a lot of research with the micronutrients and the biome and the soil and the rhizosphere and how she is regenerating. She brought statistics and her research that she's been doing in New Zealand, Australia, as well as in the U.S., in Montana, and different places, that she had video of going out, and the soil was hard as a rock. She had somebody with a shovel trying to dig. And then what she's been doing within 2 years right in the field next door was soft and had plenty of nutrients, and she says it's amazing what has been able to be done with micronutrients in the soil in a short amount of time, making it from hard rock, hard pans into a very productive water holding capacity has increased. She also had pictures of fields next door where, like in Australia, where it had rained several inches, and the one field was flooded, and just a few yards away, the other field had absorbed all the water, and it was moist, and the plants were growing, and the other one was plants were dead because there was water sitting on top, and they weren't getting oxygen.
Well, this is really wonderful to have that research that you have heard about. Interesting, though, it's in New Zealand.
She's from New Zealand. The professor is. But she's been doing research
here.
Worldwide.
Yes.
In the U.S. and Australia, New Zealand.
Yes.
But there's getting to be a little more people embracing that and understanding it. I actually talked to a couple farmers in the last month who mentioned it to me, and they're more your traditional farmers that are, they're planting a lot of corn and soybeans and using whatever they need to produce a crop. And traditionally, that's been, it's been pushed by the big corporations to use a lot of chemicals pesticides that were needed. You had to do this. But anyway, a couple of them have mentioned, hey, Gina, have you heard about what they're doing with these micronutrients and probiotics and putting it in the soil? He said, I think we're going to be able to lower our amounts of chemicals. And so I was real excited to hear that from him.
And I think with this new weather patterns we're getting, more and more intense storms, that to have your soil be a sponge would be pretty, pretty valuable.
Yes. And I think we shouldn't just look at farmers. I mean, I think all through our towns, because that's the majority of people who are also putting lots of chemicals on our lawns and our golf courses and all other green spaces, parks in town. I think there's a big potential for a lot of us in, you know, here in Ames. We get lots of water, and it's sometimes a problem. And I think we can also, you know, with these micronutrients and help our soils be healthier, that would also help us, our soils, not only be healthier, but also hold a lot more water.
Well, that sounds like a good advertisement for the heart of Iowa we're going to do with the rest of the talks, because that was just the first of a number of very stimulating talks. So this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Your co-host Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, have been talking about climate solutions from wind power to regenerative agriculture. For the balance of our program, we'll highlight a remarkable concert by the McGill McHale Trio, brought to us by Ames, Town & Gown. Paula Forrest came in to describe it to us.
Hi, Susan. I'm Paula Forrest, and I'm the artistic director of the Ames, Town & Gown Chamber Music Association. And we bring internationally renowned musicians to Ames. And this year we are especially emphasizing global connections through music. We bring in renowned musicians from all over the world, and we have our next concert coming up Thursday, March 5th.
Well, I understand this is an unusually special concert, and could you tell us about that?
Well, it's unusually special in that there's a personal connection. That's what makes it particularly special to me. Well, the two brothers, Damari and Anthony McGill, clarinetist and flutist, have recently formed a trio with Michael McHale, who's a pianist. But the two brothers were fabulous young artists whom I first came in contact when they were about 13 and 16. And they were studying at Interlaken. And they were stars even then. It was clear that they would do amazing things. And the clarinetist, Anthony McGill, studied with my father there. And so I got to know him personally. And although I didn't know Damari as personally, I heard him play a flute concerto by Ibert when he was 16 that I will never forget. And that was about 30 years ago.
Well, when I asked Carol Horowitz to give me some background information to find out if she'd interviewed you on KHOI Previews the Arts, she told me that they came here because they wanted to play for you in Ames, Iowa.
Oh, well, that's very sweet. I will confess that I contacted Anthony personally rather than going to his manager first. And I contacted him, reminded him of the connections, and then it went from there. And I think that they did make a special effort to come to Ames. I like to think that.
Can you tell us a little about what they're going to be playing?
Yes, they are going to be playing a very interesting and eclectic program. Everything will be from the 19th through the 21st centuries. They're playing works by Debussy and Poulenc and Saint-Saëns, Rachmaninoff, Villa-Lobos. Those are familiar names to us. But they're playing three newer works that I just think are fascinating. One is by an American composer named Chris Rogerson. And then they're playing something by a French composer named Connaisson and an Irish composer named Hammond. And I didn't mention that Michael McHale, the pianist, is from Belfast, Ireland.
So it's really an international.
It's really international. And I also didn't mention what makes these guys such superstars. Anthony McGill, the clarinetist, many people will remember seeing him play on the Capitol steps during the Obama inauguration with Yo-Yo Ma and Itzhak Perlman. And he then went on to become the principal clarinet of the Metropolitan Opera, and then about 2 years ago was named principal clarinet of the New York Philharmonic at a relatively young age. And his brother, Damari McGill, is the principal clarinet in the Seattle Symphony. They both teach at top music schools. Anthony teaches at Juilliard and Curtis and Peabody. Damari teaches at the Cincinnati Conservatory. And so they are teachers as well as performers, and they will also be doing master classes on Thursday.
Oh, really? And so how do they do the master classes? Do students come in, or how do they?
Students have been chosen by the music faculty at Iowa State University, and there will be three flutists and three clarinetists. There will be two separate master classes going on simultaneously. And one of the flutists is a high school student, and the other students will all be from Iowa State University.
Sounds like a very rich experience the next couple days.
Absolutely, and the students are beside themselves with excitement.
Exactly when and where is this concert?
Okay, the concert itself is Thursday night, March 5th. That's tomorrow. And it will be in the music hall at Iowa State University in Ames, the Ellen Tye Recital Hall. And it starts at 7:30 p.m., in the afternoon, the same day, from 12:30 to 2, will be the master classes. And those will also be at the music department. One will be in the recital hall, and one will be across the lobby in another room. And as I said, one will be a flute master class, one will be a clarinet master class.
Now, for a master class, is there an audience?
Absolutely. It's open to the public. And that's what makes it a master class. It's like the student performs and then gets an open lesson from the master.
Now, these musicians look like they're very young for such distinguished careers. Do you have any idea how old they are?
I believe that I know that Anthony and Damari, the two brothers, are in their early 40s. And I'm not sure about Michael McHale, but they're all quite young, definitely young in spirit. Wonderful personalities, and just really, really looking forward to having them here.
Now, we have time for a piece, and I see you brought in a CD. Do you have a recommendation for us to play?
Try Techno Parade by Guillaume Connesson.
Maybe
it's Techno Parade. He's French.
Well, here it is.
Thank you.
We just heard about the McGill-McHale Trio Concert taking place tomorrow, March 6th at 7:30 at Martha Ellen's High Recital Hall in the Music Building at ISU. For tickets, go to www.amestownandgown, all one word, I won't spell it out for you, amestownandgown.org. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Gina McAndrews and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Max DeBrixio, Finian Makepeace, and Paula Forrest.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org.
Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was the McGill-McHale Trio playing Techno Parade from the CD Portraits. And Footprints by Miles Davis from the CD Miles Smiles.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know if you decide to become a member or renew your membership. You can go to the website today and just click on the yellow button that says Become a Member and Donor.
Yes, that's a new one. So everybody who's jaded from our old, click the donate button. There isn't any donate button anymore. It's got more words on it. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI is provided in part by Stevens Auditorium, presenting Waitress, Thursday, March 12th at 7 p.m. Tickets and more information at center.iastate.edu.